Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Judy Joy Jones Show. The theme show song that you've been listening to was composed by Belgian composer Stefan Maelaars, and he titled it the Judy Joy Jones Show theme. Stefan was a guest about 2 months ago, and he was inspired and wrote that piece, which is absolutely lovely. Thank you, Stefan. I would like to welcome everyone and tell you that tonight's guest is Dr. Stanislav Grof, MD. He is a psychiatrist, author, and pioneer in his research on uses of psychedelics and non-drug techniques in psychotherapy for the past 35 years. And Dr. Grof has accepted the prestigious Vision 97 Award in Prague in 2007. There is a lot to tell about him, and I am really, really honored that Dr. Grof has accepted being our guest tonight. And I want everyone to go to the description page of our show, and on it you're going to see three of Dr. Grof's books scrolling by. And they are available through Amazon.com. The first one is called The Ultimate Journey. And the second one you see is called When the Impossible Happens. And the third one you see is Psychology in the Future. And all three books Dr. Grof will talk about tonight, hopefully. And you can also purchase them through Amazon.com. So we're really honored that they are for sale through Amazon.com, and Dr. Grof will be discussing the books. Also, I wanted to mention that tomorrow night we are going to have the well-known, probably most well-known female attorney on the earth, and her name is Gloria Allred. And Gloria has been the attorney for so many people that I can't even begin to name, but everyone knows about her, and I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to have one of Blog Talk Radio's own people that work for Blog Talk. They're going to co-host the show. So tomorrow night, 7 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, Miss Gloria Allred. And let me go ahead and tell you a little bit more about our guests tonight. And I always feel like the guests themselves are better at talking about themselves. But anyway, Dr. Grof, Stanislav Grof, is one of the founders of Transpersonal Psychology. And he is the founding president of the International Transpersonal Association. And Dr. Grof emphasizes the concept a birth trauma as a critical psychic experience. I'll tell you on a personal note, I did hear Dr. Groff at Mind States. He was at, they had a thing called Mind States at Berkeley, UC Berkeley in California, several years ago with one of the painters that I really like, Alex Gray. And I heard him talk, and I really never forgot what he talked about, and I'm jotted down. If I ever get a chance, I'd like to know more, and tonight we will find out more. So let's go ahead and bring him up. Hello, Dr. Groff? Hello?
You have me, the co-host, Shelley.
Hi, Shelley. Hi, how are you? Okay, well, my co-host came on first. So her name is Shelley. She's going to be helping us tonight. How are you doing, Shelley?
Just fine.
Great. Let me see if Dr. Groff... Okay.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you tonight?
Okay, great.
Great. We have a co-host, Dr. Groff. Her name is Shelley.
Hi, Shelley.
And
hello, Dr. Groff.
I am really honored you accepted to be our guest tonight, and we would love to know in your own words. I always read these things, but I think that your own bio in your own words is much, much more personable. If you'd like to tell us a little more about yourself.
Well, I was born in Prague, Czechoslovakia, where I also studied medicine at the Charles University School of Medicine, and then became specialized in psychiatry and also got a psychoanalytic training. And at the time when I started being disappointed with psychoanalysis, I volunteered for an experiment with LSD, and that just generated a lifetime interest and passion for the study of non-ordinary states of consciousness of various kinds.
Non-ordinary. So, I understand. Dr. Groff, would it be all right if I asked you to speak a little bit louder? Unfortunately, the tech thing is that you can hear me, the host, but the guest, if you have a voice that's a little soft, if you could speak a little louder, that would be great.
Okay, how is it now? Is it better?
Much better, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so the last thing I said, that I volunteered for this LSD experiment at the psychiatric clinic in Prague, and
mm-hmm.
I had this powerful, really life-transforming experience that sent my life professionally and personally in an entirely new direction. And so in the last more than 50 years, I have really done very little professionally that would not be related in one way or another to these non-ordinary states of consciousness. This became my vocation, my profession, my passion, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I studied, you know, very intensively these different kinds of these non-ordinary states and the implications what these kinds of observations make for psychiatry, for psychology, psychotherapy, and even the philosophy of science. You know, I believe there are very, very profound implications of this research that have yet to be acknowledged by mainstream psychiatry.
So you are like a pioneer. You're a trailblazer in new forms of psychotherapy. I would imagine that's been maybe a lonely path, but...
Well, there have been colleagues, you know. I discussed
uh-huh.
so far the work in Prague at the Psychiatric Research Institute, but then in 1967 I came to the United States on a scholarship, and I joined a team at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Baltimore
mm-hmm.
that was basically the last surviving research project in the United States after all the legal restrictions. So there was a wonderful group of people, you know, where we share these interests
yes.
and we could exchange information. So it was lonely in terms of, I think, the culture, but not in terms of individual relations. I had a lot of really wonderful friends.
Will you tell us more about them?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Shelley, what did you say?
Will he tell us more about his associate in the research and some of the early
experiments? Well, in Prague, in Prague, this was a small group. I had two other colleagues at the same research institute who were doing the same kind of work. In Prague, this was a very limited research, although there were 40 other groups all over Czechoslovakia who were doing this work. But then when I came to Maryland, to the Psychiatric Research Center, it was a group of about 12 people and their families.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a really nice group. There was Sandy Unger, who was, before I came, he was like the mastermind of this whole project, who designed this large project, working with neurotic patients, with alcoholics, with hard drug addicts, and also with people dying of cancer. There was also Walter Pankey, who had an MD, PhD, and a divinity degree from Harvard. So he was the one who actually designed this this research project with cancer patients, and also was the person who got the finances, who managed to do the appropriate fundraising for it.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Bill Richards, who currently is part of a team at Johns Hopkins that completed a study showing that psilocybin, which is a substance very similar to LSD, can induce mystical experiences. So this was a widely publicized research, and they are now beginning to replicate some of the studies that we did with cancer patients. There are two other places now. One is UCLA, one is Harvard, when they are returning to psychedelic research. So that's very, very exciting. So hopefully in the future the researchers will not be as isolated as we were.
Absolutely. That's, I love Alex Gray's art, and I know that he has used, various substances and continues to. And, really and truly, I'm not quite understanding why LSD is not, let's say, available to the average person through an MD. Will that come about, in your opinion, Dr. Groff, at some point in time?
Well, I think what happened, initially LSD was really used primarily in medical circles.
Mm-hmm.
And the sessions were done in a very, although we didn't know very much in the early years, this was a completely new substance. We had no idea where the research is going to take us. But it was understood that people have to be prepared. You have to sit down, discuss the session with them, create a certain kind of a relationship of trust. Then when they have the session, there have to be at least one, or in many instances, two people, a male-female team with that person for 6 to 8 hours, and then we kept the people overnight and then saw them in the morning and to make sure that everything was okay. So it was done in a very responsible way, although there was not much knowledge available at that time. And then what happened is that primarily because of Timothy Leary, that the substance was kind of released and was used in a very kind of uncontrolled way, frequently in large group situations like Woodstock and so on.
Yeah.
Then, of course, you increase the possibility of risk and you reduce the positive potential. Things happened that were then widely publicized by kind of sensation hunting journalists, and then there was this administrative, legislative response, suppression, legal suppression that happened. What happened was very, very sad, is that the legislators and the academic circles didn't really pay attention to the information that came from responsible research with psychedelics, and they focused primarily on you know, all the negative things that happened when
yeah.
it was used, you know, in a
More negative,
much less responsible way.
Irresponsible way. Well, you know, this is kind of getting away from this particular topic, but I'm very curious to know if you came from a family or history of psychiatrists, psychotherapists, or MDs in your family?
No, my mother was a concert pianist originally.
Oh.
And my father, it was a little closer, well, not quite. He studied chemistry, but then then he actually got involved in pharmaceutical companies.
Oh,
so
okay.
he was more involved in business than in, you know, the chemistry itself.
Right, right.
So no, there were no real precedents in our family. I was my brother is a psychiatrist, and I am a psychiatrist.
Oh, your brother.
Mm-hmm. My brother's in Canada, in Ottawa.
And you make your home in the United States, or both?
I came in 1967, and the first 7 years I was in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins and at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center. And then I moved to California, and I spent some time at the Esalen Institute as scholar in residence. And now we are living in Mill Valley, which is really part of San Francisco, just the second community when you cross Golden Gate Bridge. And teaching at a school called California Institute of Integral Studies, or CIAS.
Oh, of course. And so Esalen, I remember, I think that was like the 1960s or early 70s.
Big Sur. It was.
Yeah, the Big Sur, absolutely.
I was there. Would you tell us about your experience with Fritz Perls and the beginnings of the, that you made the switch from to body work through that? In other words, it was possible to do body work with no use of drugs and get into
all things. Well, you know, Esalen is a wonderful, wonderful place, just stunning natural beauty. It's on the Pacific coast between the south of Carmel, between San Francisco and Los Angeles. It's old Indian territory. The Esalen Indians, you know, were the original inhabitants of that place. The place has hot springs. And originally it was a motel. And Michael Murphy, who inherited it from his father, didn't want to run a hotel, and he started really what is called a human potential center, where people who had some very original ideas and developed some techniques that were a little too far out for mainstream, you know, for the universities or research institute or even mainstream clinical facilities, could go and offer this in the form of workshops. So some amazing people were there, and major contribution was made over the years to psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. Fritz Perls lived there, developed Gestalt practice. Will Schutz, who was one of the originators of group therapy. Virginia Satir was affiliated with Esalen, and she's the one who developed family therapy. Ida Rolf, who developed Rolfing, and then, you know, many other very, very famous pioneering people visited regularly and offered workshops at Esalen. So it was a very, very exciting place. So I lived there between 73 and 87 doing workshops and writing books. So it was a very, very exciting time for me. But, of course, once I left Maryland, I didn't have the legal permission to use psychedelics. And so I basically was doing workshops talking about the work that we did. And there were always people who were frustrated, who said, it's really great to hear about all these fantastic experiences, but can't we do something?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, sorry, I don't have the permission to give you the substance here. And then my wife, Christina, and I developed something that we call holotropic breathwork, where people just work with faster breathing, and we use powerful, evocative music, a lot of it coming either from native traditions or from spiritual traditions. And there's a certain kind of body work involved, and people get extremely deep, and we see basically the same spectrum of experiences that we used to see in psychedelic sessions, only there are no substances involved.
And it's just a deep breathing.
Well, it's the focus is more on faster breathing and kind of tying the exhalation and the inhalation into kind of a circle of breath. But then the most important thing is the quality of attention that you give. It's very much like a really deep and spiritual practice and accelerated spiritual.
Do you incorporate
so people have experiences of things that happened to them when they were infants? They can relive their birth, they can get back into prenatal life. We see past life experiences, mystical experiences, you know, encounters with what Jung called archetypal beings, so deities and other kind of figures from different mythologies. So it's a very, very rich spectrum that can be accessed through holotropic breathwork. We also have a training for facilitators where people can come and attend what we call modules, training modules, sort of six-day units. And when they have seven of them, then there is a two-week certification for these facilitators.
Okay, and how do they do that, Dr. Groff? How do they find out about that or get in touch with that to do that?
Well, we have... We have two websites. One website is very easy to remember, holotropic.com.
Okay.
Where people can find everything about the training and about breathwork and, you know, books that are available and other things. And I have a personal website which also gives you all that information, but people can download many, many papers and... they have links to various interesting websites. So that's my full first and second name, Stanislav Groff, together.
Right.
.com.
Right. And we have that listed right there on the description of tonight's show, along with three of your books. And that's StanislavGroff.com. I also put up off of your website, I found another page that I thought was quite interesting, www.stanislavgroff.com/pressroom.htm. And
yeah,
also, go ahead.
Yeah, that's the expansion of that. StanislavGroff.com. And then you can do /index. Press room.
But
if you just use the first part, it can get you to the website, and then you
can get all of it. Right. And also then Wikipedia. You know, one of the things about this show is that it's heard internationally by many, many types of people. So sometimes I kind of go into more detail than I need to for some people and less for more, but I want everyone to find out about you because I feel that maybe 100 years at the very least ahead of your time. And, you know, Shelley and I were talking. What was it you asked about, Shelley, what the future held for our psychotherapy?
While I have the floor, would we ask Dr. Groff to speak a little louder again?
Are you
louder?
Having...
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yes. I guess we've answered around several topics. I wanted to know more about your book, When the Impossible Happens. Can you speak a little to that?
Yes. Well, what happened in, 1971, I was approaching my 70th birthday, and I was preparing to at least semi-retire and do a little more reading and writing. But then our house burned down in February 2001, and we lost everything, basically including my library, about 4,000 books. And so it became very difficult to write books of the kind I used to, where you need to reference other people's books, you know, find different passages and so on. And so I decided to write a book of personal stories, but not a biography, but a collection of really wild stories, sort of things, very extraordinary things that happened to us when we had contact with shamans in different countries, with yogis, with Tibetan masters, strange synchronicities that happened, or people having experiences of past lives in other centuries that we could verify, kind of a long memory, you know, reaching back several centuries. And so what is the common denominator in all those stories is that what is described there should not be possible if the universe were the way it's described by materialistic science. And so this is where the title comes from, When the Impossible Happens, because our, you know, average person in our culture would consider all those things impossible. They should not happen.
Of course, the most common experience we all share is birth and death. And from your early beginnings in your experiments with LSD, presumably you went beyond those dimensions and saw how the two tie together. As you would say, we experience these chains that go through many lives that individuals at least feel they have re-experienced through the deep breath work, and maybe you could speak to that.
Yeah, well, this was, you know, a very exciting aspect of this work. I came into it with medical training, psychiatric training, Freudian psychoanalytic training, but, you know, according to all these different parts of my training, the psyche was supposed to be limited to what happens to you after you're born. Freud said a newborn is a tabula rasa, it's a clean slate. There is really nothing there that precedes birth, including birth itself. Birth is not considered a psychotrauma. It's not considered something that is recorded in our memory, that's available to our memory. So what came to me in this work, first with psychedelics, but then confirmed with the work with the breathwork, is that there is a very powerful record of all the stages of birth that we had been through as we were coming into this world, and also the record of that encounter with death that we had, because, you know, life, depending how difficult the birth is, life is threatened to different degrees. I mean, there are people among us who died in the birth canal and had to be resuscitated, and there are people who were born half dead, kind of blue, and and even if the birth was not really extreme, you know, there was a significant life-challenging struggle that was involved. There is a level in our unconscious when there is a powerful record of birth, and it's all entangled with the experience of death. So birth and death are kind of linked together in our unconscious.
Oh, please go on.
But then, the fascinating thing was that it didn't stop there. Then, one, I sort of got a little familiar with this area of birth and death. Then I started seeing that people, including myself, were actually experiencing prenatal experiences. And it didn't even stop there, and we started seeing and experiencing episodes from the life of our ancestors, animal ancestors, past life experiences when something is coming from another century, from another country, with a sense of personal remembering. You know, this is not the first time this is happening to me.
Which of your books would most record this?
Well, I mentioned that in 2001, you know, I was approaching my 70th birthday, and I got a letter from my editor from State University of New York Press, who said, you know, Dr. Grove, you have written several books for us. They published many of them. And so the different aspects of your work kind of are distribute it in different books. Would you consider writing one book that would kind of bring it together, that would really summarize everything that you have seen during these years? And then she said, Anne, would you specifically focus on the things that you have seen and experienced that current science cannot explain? And then she said, as you can see, this is a tall order. Then she said, and would you also suggest what changes would have to be made in psychiatry, in psychology, in psychotherapy to somehow accommodate and assimilate, you know, these new observations and experiences? And so I was very, very excited because we were at this point having a training all over the world, and we needed a handbook, you know, that that people could use for teaching. And so I wrote this book as it was ordered, and I gave it a kind of deliberately provocative title, Psychology of the Future.
Which
at the same time reflects my true belief that if you look at all these observations, that it would lead to a really profound revolution in our thinking that would be comparable to what happened to physics in the first three decades of the 20th century, when they moved from Newton to Einstein and then to quantum theory. I think that the changes would be that profound.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we had Dr. Michio Kaku on our show, and he was talking about physics and all the things that he felt were coming up, and it's quite amazing, you know, to really look at the future. And I feel like you are the future. You're it's kind of like what you know. You're telling us it's going to be coming up in 50 or 100 years. Are you writing another book right now, Dr. Groff, or are you planning to do more books?
My wife Christina and I are finally, after doing the breath work for many, many years, for over 30 years, we are now writing actually a book about the breath work, which is called Theory and Practice of Holotropic Breathwork.
Oh, great. Yeah. And when will that be out?
Well, we hope to finish it probably by the end of January. Then it depends on the publishers, you know, how quickly they get it out.
Yeah.
Will you have specific...
So probably in a year or so.
A year,
To the question that was asked previously, Psychology of the Future would be the book to begin for people who want to get a sense, because it's a real kind of synopsis, you know, of everything that we have done. And there are different chapters, and each chapter describes a certain aspect of that work. And if people get interested, there's always a book behind it. So there's, for example, a chapter on the insights that we got about death, consciousness and death. And then there is a book which is called The Ultimate Journey that people can read, or there's a book that summarizes the most far-out kind of metaphysical insights that people have about the nature of the universe, nature of human beings, and meaning of life, and reincarnation, and good and evil.
You know, Dr. Groff, would you be willing to take a call? We have a caller.
Sure.
All right. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
Fine, how are you?
All right. I just want to have a question for the psychic.
Please, yes.
Okay, my name is Melvin, and I was just calling about a relationship. This friend of mine that I met, and I like her, but I don't know if she's the right one for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what's going on.
Excuse me, Melvin, you have the wrong show. We're not doing relationship counseling.
Well,
but
if Dr. Groff has an answer, I might.
Well, you know, before
before
you can do this kind of counseling, you really have to have the people there. You have to sit down with them, and you know, it would take some time to really get a sense
of the
people
whole
who are involved and what the chances are for that.
Right.
Relationship to
well, Melvin, I appreciate you calling in.
But let me speak to Melvin. If you have tapped in with the energy of our program, it shows that your relationship to yourself is your paramount and proper motivation. And good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Continue.
Thanks for calling, Melvin. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. You have a good day.
Thank you.
Yeah, I am sorry. That's not...
No, that's all right, Dr. Brown. We don't...
to answer. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you see, it's when we relate to the other, it's really a reflection to ourselves. And
well, yeah.
That he would call now. And, let's use this opportunity, Dr. Groff, because so much is about projection to the importance of the other. And your work really makes each of us empowered in our own power, the experience with the individual. It's not that the profoundness is so difficult or abstract. It's within each one's reach. And Judy and I were discussing that in this day and age, people may feel it's a luxury to seek out a personal body work therapies, and yet once they have the understanding and the tools from perhaps even a few sessions, they can take the ball and run with it, and so much better relate to
Of the economy. I mean, when you know, at one point going to a psychiatrist was not out of the question, but in this country, perhaps at this point, healthcare in offices and corporations may not offer that. Dr. Groff, what would your suggestion be to people that really would like to know more and experiment, and how are they going to do this? What would you say?
Well, you
say?
See, you pointed out a very, very important aspect of this work, like the holotropic breath work,
okay. Which
is that we put tremendous emphasis on what we call the inner healer. If you look at the other psychotherapies, each of them has a different idea about how you work with people, how
right.
the psyche works, why
right.
the symptoms are there, what they mean. You get
right.
different interpretations with different schools, whereas in the holotropic breathwork, the emphasis is that you find your own answers. So basically, we create a supportive environment. You lie down, you do the faster breathing, we play some music, and
mm-hmm.
you get the answers from your own psyche, and we would be supporting you in that. And the other advantage is that we work in groups.
Okay.
It's you get a very different economy. So we have now trained over 1,000 people. So it's very likely that people who would like to do the breathwork, that they find somebody in their environment. And when you work in groups, again, the
mm-hmm.
finances are a little different
than going
with
on
an individual
therapist, like,
because
uh-huh.
it's distributed. I mean, the costs are distributed.
Yes, I remember in the 70s we had many group workshops. They were affordable, but it was very important to watch others work and to have the support of the group members as you went through your own experience. Often, just to make it more realistic,
you learn a lot from others. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the support, you may go back into childhood, you may cry, you may feel bullied by classmates and come shining through with a new confidence because of the vulnerability that is so intrinsic to these therapy sessions. It's all about vulnerability in a safe environment.
That's
so anyway,
right.
to answer the question, I think people would find somebody who has been through the training in their area, so they don't have to travel. And there are people who offer groups where people meet in regular intervals, and they can do some very profound self-exploration, which consists, of the work they do themselves, but also assisting other people, hearing other people's stories. So there's a different kind of a learning on a much larger scale than if you just do it in a one-to-one situation?
You know, Dr. Groff, I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I found it to be very, very interesting, and on the other hand, a little intimidating that I should need to remember all of these ways after I cross over into another dimension, who to go to, what to go to, what color, what light. And I wonder, what is your concept of that? Is there a simpler means that we could teach each other how to cross over in a more a simpler way, where we don't have to remember not to go to this one, but to go, you know, without a guru? It was a little confusing.
Well, you know, what we have seen is, as I mentioned before, that one important category of experiences that you have would be encounters with various archetypal sort of mythological beings or visiting various mythological realms. But it doesn't have to be the Tibetan. I mean, people are basically taken spontaneously by their process to a certain mythology which is appropriate to them.
Okay.
And very many people feel that if you have experiences in these non-ordinary states, whether it's psychedelics or the breath work or some shamanic experiences and so on, that you are basically practicing dying, that you are already getting certain adventures and experiences in the realm which are very similar to those that you will experience when you die. I mentioned our study that we did with cancer patients, you know, where people dying of cancer had psychedelic experiences. And we had several instances where people had actually real near-death experience after they had psychedelic experiences with us. And they said, we were very glad that we had the psychedelic experiences because the terrain was not new to us.
Oh, did they saw?
It was like a more familiar experience.
A familiar.
So they actually went deep into the realm of death, but they were resuscitated.
So now, Dr. Groff, do you see in the future that we will have dying centers where we're able to go perhaps into a room instead of going to retirement homes and perhaps experience colors, music, and cross over when we are ready? Is that a future that I'm seeing, or is that a fantasy?
Well, I think that would be an important part of it, but we could also do something that all the ancient and native cultures did, which is practicing the dying as we go through life.
Okay.
These cultures had powerful rituals, you know, particularly one category of rituals, which are called rites of passage.
Okay.
Like puberty rites, rites when you are getting married, menopause rites and so on, and various healing ceremonies. They all deal with these non-ordinary states, which are the states that you experience in the process of dying. So you can do a lot of the homework of, that prepare you for dying. You can do it as you go through life, and then certainly we should have some centers, the way Huxley described it in his book, The Island. You know, where people again have a ritual, so they are dying with the support of this ritual context. In Huxley's book, they were using something called moksha, which were basically mushrooms, you know, psychedelic mushrooms. But
right.
Again, we could use, you know, we could certainly use the breathwork. We could use music. We could use. Today we have fantastic special effects. I mean, you could use various optical effects, you know, as part of it. So I think in general we should sort of bring back somehow this tradition of these non-ordinary states, whether it's psychedelics or some non-drug methods, which we have now. And as Jung said, you know, to live our life in such a way that we don't focus only on what's happening outside, that we sort of also go deep inside and we tap the wisdom of what he calls the self with a capital S, or where we get sort of information from the from the collective unconscious, and we then live our life in such a way that what we experience on the outside is combined with what comes out from this deep inner experience, and then we synthesize it into the experience of our life. We are a culture that has projected everything on the outside, you know, creating problems on the outside and trying to solve them outside by some economic sanctions or military interventions or diplomatic interventions. And in the process, we create more problems than we solve because we are using the same strategies that get us into the trouble in the first place.
Yes.
So I think we need some kind of profound transformation of consciousness of the human species to get to a different place where we don't head for, you know, destruction of the planet and self-destruction.
Well, when we kind of realize, like you're saying, that the death is a continual process, and we outgrow things, and we discard old clothes as we grow, as we learn, as we get into a bigger area of thinking, then I understand totally what you're saying, that when we do let go of the body or the outer realm, then it's not that big of a change. It's more of a natural progression. But we need teachers, I think, in this country and probably in other countries, to teach us how to do that, how to kind of to remember to let go, not hold on, because we can't. But I think we try to. Some people do more than others. But really what you're saying is death is a natural progression. But now when we do finally let go of the body, we let go of the outer realm, do we just take on another one? I mean, what happens? Do we choose another outer dressing, a body, or do we go on to another dimension?
No, you know, it's a very complex question. I wrote about it in some detail in the book, The Ultimate Journey, Consciousness and the Mystery of Death. You know, initially when I studied medicine, it seemed like any kind of reference to reincarnation and karma was basically nonsense.
Yeah.
I knew that I was going from conception to death, and when the body dies, the brain goes and consciousness goes, and that's it. But the 50 years, you know, of study of non-ordinary states changed that very, very radically. And, you know, we don't have a proof that reincarnation exists, but we have some research that has been done that makes it, you know, fairly plausible that it might be there. Not just the study of past life experiences that I was talking about, but there's a fantastic research of Ian Stevenson, who just died last year, and he studied children in different parts of the world who were between the age of 3 and 5, were remembering previous incarnation, and he wrote a number of books about it, and he was able in some instances identify the place they were talking about, the village or the town, and actually brought the children there, and they knew the topography of the place, they knew people by name, they could take him to a place where they lived and really basically confirm their story. And his last work was fantastic. It was 2 volumes called Karma and Biology, where he actually uses autopsy records and everything, where he found out that when many of these children, when they were talking about their life and death in previous lifetime, they described how they died. Maybe they were shot or they were stabbed to death. And then when they found out the person they were talking about and got the autopsy record, they confirmed the story, but then also the child had a very prominent birthmark in the place where they were mortally wounded. So there's an excessive, you know, material there that where he's comparing these various physical marks in the bodies of these children with the type of death that they had in this supposed previous incarnation. So there's a lot of really you know, pretty amazing material. None of it is really, you know, final proof, but it certainly shows that it's a fascinating area that should be studied.
So the continuation, you know, I think that I would like personally to see more hospices and areas that are houses that people could go to in the United States. That would be, you know, kind of, well, a really happy place. Nothing sad, nothing morose, but really a transition to a really higher state of consciousness. And I hope that those are coming. As of now, I've been in several homes that are retirement homes, and I really must say there's not a lot of joy, but I think there could be.
In some of them, you know, in some of them, I think there are exceptions. We have a
uh-huh.
we have a nice place in Mill Valley called Redwood.
Okay.
They're pretty cheerful people, and then, you know, every Saturday they sort of come out into the street, and they have all kinds of political posters, and they communicate with the drivers who go by.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know.
Yeah, so it's just a matter of getting, yeah.
Not really a dismal place.
Right. I know in Maui, Hawaii, I lived in Maui, and they had some lovely places. So I guess it depends on where you are and you know, what community that you're in. But
the whole idea of hospice is pretty new, you know. It's mm-hmm. in the late 60s when Cecily Saunders started that in London.
Who was that? I'm sorry?
Cecily Saunders. She
oh, okay.
started this whole movement. And of course, you know, Kubler-Ross brought a lot of attention.
Oh,
to,
Dr. Ross,
to
yeah.
And so on.
Yeah, she was.
But I am with you. You know, what we did with our cancer patients, we brought, after they had the session, we brought the music to them to the hospital and gave them a Sony.
Mm.
And we were encouraging them to work with the. Many, many dying people have actually visions, you know, that include visions of their dead relatives
yes.
and so on, like a welcoming
yes.
committee coming and so on. And generally people get tranquilizers for that. And we sort of validated these experiences and asked patients to work with the music and actually let themselves go into those experiences. It's much better than listening to the paging in the hospital, you know, and all the noise.
Oh, absolutely.
So and they really love that to be in the realm of the music and the inner experience rather than focusing on all the chaos around them.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Dr. Graf, I can't thank you enough. I know you weren't familiar with me or my show or anything else, and you were kind enough and brave enough to reach out and actually
like you're doing wonderful work.
Oh, thank you. I want to share.
We need that,
so
you know, to bring more of this kind of information into the culture. I think many people in our culture confuse spirituality with religion, you know, and they're finding all
yeah.
kinds of bad things about organized religion, and they tend to dismiss any kind of spiritual quest because they don't see the difference. Spirituality is something that has to do with inner quest and inner experience. You know, religion is an organized activity on the outside, and you know, the inner experiences you find primarily in the mystical branches of the religions and in the monastic branches where people actually do fasting and prayers and meditation and so on, which is very different. You know, organized religion very frequently gets into the traps, the secular traps of power and politics and money and
yes.
control and so on, and then
and control, yes.
And differences between religions and even inside the religions are enough to kill each other, you know.
That's
so many
right.
people don't have a great image of religions, and then they dismiss anything spiritual because they don't see an alternative.
Dr. Graf, out of your tragic loss of your library. And your home years ago came a new book based on just fresh material without access to that research. Before you leave, will you speak to the intense coping that we're all having to go through right now, being put on the spot, intense change, and yet
to go through what? Hello.
Judy? Yes, Judy.
To go through what? I didn't get.
I'm sorry, Sharon. Shelley, we couldn't hear you. Go through what?
Oh, in intense loss and rising above to cope. In other words, as you. Without benefit of your library, the loss of your home comes
uh-huh.
a book on fresh with just fresh material. Could you speak to just the times many of us are going through now of sudden shift, change, loss?
Oh, I
see.
Right.
You know, for us, it was really, I would call it a death rebirth experience because
yes.
we managed to rebuild our home. You know, it's much nicer and newer than it was before. It was only two very difficult years dealing with the insurance company and dealing with the PG&E that caused the that caused the fire.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, this was more a difficult experience, but not a permanent loss. We managed to recreate our life in a new way. But in terms of the situation that we are facing now, you know,
right,
in a group dynamic,
I think that doing some kind of a systematic inner work actually helps you to cope with the difficulties of life. You know, but you get an entirely different perspective. One of the major things is to accept impermanence. You know, to accept. Change, to accept death, because many of us tend to live as if we are immortal, you know.
Yeah,
that's right.
But as Buddha said, you know, everything that we have, we will lose. And there are many ways you can suffer. You can suffer by not having what you want to have. You can suffer to have something that you want to have, because then you become being afraid that you are going to lose it.
Yes.
You know, we are afraid of death and disease and so on. Those are all things that are part of life. So people who do this inner work, you can first of all work through a lot of the old traumas that tend to make your present suffering
mm-hmm.
Or reaction to unpleasant things more profound.
Yes.
Because you don't respond just to what's happening now, but to what's happening, what happened in the past, what you still have not.
We can be more flexible.
Worked through. You also would have very powerful experiences, including very challenging experiences that would make some of the changes in everyday life more tolerable. You would have a different baseline for that.
Yes.
And that's great.
That something like, you know, intense spiritual practice and the breathwork, for example, is just an enhanced or deepened form of spiritual practice.
Different.
But there are many, many different ways you can do that. But that this deep inner work help you really to cope with the problems that
it's all related.
That you
it is. Well, I want to thank you, but I want everyone to go to
if
our...
I can say one last thing, you know, most...
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Is to be able to be as much as you can in the present. Because
oh.
a lot of our suffering goes happens from
oh.
anticipation how bad things will be. We saw it in the cancer patients. When they could kind of create a situation where they said, okay, I'm alive today, you know, I'm can sort of take what is happening, and tomorrow is another day.
Mm-hmm.
They got into a much better place when they... than when they were concerned about how bad things will get next week and, next month and so on. That anticipation of the bad and the load of unresolved past things somehow make the reaction to the present situation much more difficult.
That's right. Well, I want to thank you both. We've got about 30 seconds. And Dr. Groff, I wish you the very best. You're welcome back anytime. And everyone, please... Do check out Dr. Graf's books, and three of them are scrolling before your eyes on the description page of tonight's show. Dr. Graf was actually featured by the radio show, and his book is scrolling in front of millions of people, and we are just honored to have you as our guest. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and let me know when you have another opening. I'll
please
be more
come back.
To talk to you.
Thank you, Shelley.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Good night.